I move the adoption of the agenda.
Chair, second.
Thanks, Adam. Can we do what I usually find very useful before we start a quick introduction? And I'll start with myself, Mondlu Kumugale, the WIP Portfolio Committee, Justice and Constitutional Development, now acting chair, and then we can move.
Lawrence Bursett, Legislative Development, Justice.
Pat Moody, Promotion of the Rights of Vulnerable Groups, Department of Justice.
I'm Coria Cook, I'm from the National Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, Director of Child Justice and Family Law.
Anthony Mitchell, from the IFP, here on behalf of Dr. Ambrosini.
Doctor?
Well, I mean, people can come and sit here, it's an open meeting, but we can't, and I suppose if the space at the table, there's no objections to people sitting at the table, but we can't be formally introducing people who are not members of Parliament or representatives from the departments who've been invited. Just from a procedural point of view. So I have no objections to him being here, but he and maybe it was, well, your yes. First meeting, so we're going around the table, but I think just for future reference that the people who get introduced are the MPs and the officials and anyone else who's invited.
Shall I take that to the observer?
Yeah, observer's fine, but just not manipulable.
Okay.
Introduce yourself, Prof.
I am Lindu Musa Gabriel Ndabandaba, member of this committee and a member of ANC.
John, I was going to go on to second names, but I think I'll leave that out. John Jeffrey, member of this committee from the ANC.
Natasha Michael, member of this committee from the Democratic Alliance.
J.B. Sibanyoni, member of this committee from the ANC.
Bonan Raman, Committee Secretary.
Thanks, Honourable Member. Do we have any apologies?
The first one will be from the chairperson. The second one from Honourable Smart. And Honourable Adams is on her way. She will be joining us anytime soon.
Can you table apologies, Honourable Member?
I assume that there's an apology from Dr. Ambrosini, but maybe he should be requested to ensure that he puts his apologies to the Secretary in future.
It's a special intervention. You are not allowed to present that apology. So can I table the apology, Honourable Member? Thanks. We just have one item on the table. I usually do not support that any other business. If there's nothing to be discussed, there can be discretion. All right, we'll just.
No, just from a procedural point of view, we have adopted the agenda.
Oh.
Ms. Michaels and I. Proposed it and supported it.
That's a positive underpinning. That's a positive underpinning. I accept it. Thanks, DJ. One of the members, we've got the Child Justice Act, which was adopted in 2008, whose implementation is supposed to take place this year. The intention today is to be briefed on the regulation and the implementation plan. The department is here. Can I hand over to the department?
Thank you, Chair. We actually come from two components in the department, if I can just make that distinction. Colleagues on my left, Ina and Tandazile, are in the legislative drafting section, and colleagues on my right, Kolya and Pat, are from the Chief Directorate of Vulnerable Groups.
Legislation.
And we've been mandated to do the regulations, which we've done, and my colleagues Tanda and Ina are going to give an overview of the regulations. And possibly also, with the permission of the, if the committee agrees, some of the committee members weren't here during the when the bill was deliberated. It might be appropriate just to give a brief overview, a very broad overview of the provisions of the bill, so that we have an idea. Do that, and then we'll go into the regulations. Once we've been through the regulations, then I'm going to hand over to my colleagues from the Chief Directorate of Vulnerable Groups, Pat Moodley, who's Acting Chief Director. She's only started in that position in January, so she hasn't been part of the process, but she's taken over from Ms. Shireen Sayed, who was here the year before last when the bill was being deliberated on in Parliament. The regulations, I understand, have been tabled formally. We would have liked to have got them here earlier. We do realise there was a 1 December deadline. My colleagues will go into that detail when we outline the process. We tried our best. We put every effort in to try and get the regulations here on time, but there were some circumstances beyond the control of the department that we had to contend with. And maybe I should just say up front, Chair, and it's unfortunate, but we met with SAPS yesterday, and they, in the process of their drafting their national instructions, which the Act requires, they've come across things in the regulations which they didn't, which they were happy with in the regulations before, but when drafting their national instructions, which are going to be approved, I understand, very, very soon by the National Commission of SAPS, they've come across, I must say, just a few small technical amendments that they've asked us to convey to the committee to make their task easier in the implementation of this Act. And we've got a list here of, as I say, they're not many, and there are a few small changes, but according to SAPS, will make their life easier when they implement the bill.
So are those changes going to be effective to the substance of the bill?
Not to the bill, Chair, but to the regulations.
I'm just as one of the members that was here, was very involved in the finalization of the bill. We passed this bill June 2008. We said in the bill it must be implemented 1st of April 2010. We gave lots of time for its introduction. One of the requirements in the bill, I mean, just to explain the procedure, is that the regulations or directives, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but definitely the regulations, I'm not sure about the directives, have to be approved by Parliament. The directives. Mm-hmm. Okay, but the regulations have to be approved by Parliament. Is it the SAPS ones?
No, directives. The
instructions,
so the directives do have to be approved by Parliament.
The NPA, because it's basically regulations from the Minister, which we've got.
Yeah.
NPA directives, which have to be approved by Parliament, and SAPS?
Instructions, not.
Okay. But the NPA, the two from Justice, regulations and directives have to be approved.
Can you tell us about the instructions and directives?
Well, basically, because it's three components and there may be others, I mean, maybe Christine could just give a briefing on that, because I just want to, my point I wanted to move to was already the Act has not been complied with, and an extreme concern about that, and we need a full explanation. But I don't know, Christine, if you want Christine just to run through.
Maybe what I want us to do, if Christine can explain these vocabulary issues very quickly, so that we are on par. And then we can come to you.
Yeah. There are regulations which are, they come from Justice. Those have to be approved by Parliament. And then there are also directives. That's with the NPA.
What are
directives? Well, they would be like regulations, but they're directives. It's a different terminology.
Yes, that's what I believe from the Act, Section 97, says that the NDBP must, in consultation with the Minister for Administration of Justice, issue directives regarding all matters which are reasonably necessary or expedient to be provided for in order to achieve the objectives of this Act, including diversion, the minimum standards applicable thereto, and the factors to be considered when selecting a diversion option, and in particular the following: the diversion of matters in the case of accused persons who were 18 years or older but under the age of 21 years, the diversion of matters by a prosecutor in respect of minor offences before a preliminary inquiry in terms of Chapter 6, and regarding the manner in which matters must be dealt with where an error as to age has been discovered subsequent to the matter being diverted, and determining the exceptional circumstances in which a matter may be diverted as provided for in Section 52. I'm not going to go into the details, but I think that gives a sort of an idea of what the directives are about. I think it's going into the finer detail of how prosecutors should be going about their work so that you can get uniformity in respect to these issues that I've mentioned.
Are those countries within the regulation?
No, sir, they are
an independent element together with regulation.
That's correct. Yeah. And then the National Commission of SAPS, they must issue national instructions,
which
is similar to the directives, but it is applicable to police officials to make sure that they deal with child justice related matters in accordance with instructions, also to promote uniformity, consistency, and child sensitivity in relation to. I can also go through there the list of issues.
Am I correct to say directives, instructions, regulation are comprised in one body? And in this body, directives are trying to reconcile the implementation of that with regard to the role of the NDP. Am I correct? Instructions, the police. All right, Jeff?
Yeah, what I was going to say is, look, regulations are a particular legal concept. They can only be done by the minister. And they are regarding the implementation of the Act. The directives would be how the NPA are filling in the gaps in the Act, how they are going to implement. But because they're not coming from a minister, they're coming from the head of the NPA, they can't be regulations, so they're called directives. And the SAPS instructions are the same as the directives, but as far as binding the police.
It's reconciling this with their data and their way of...
Now, the difficulty, Chair, is that we have to approve the regulations, and if we don't approve the regulations before the commencement of the Act, then they're deemed to be approved. In order to make sure that we didn't get the thing rushed to us, the Act provides for, and it's Section 98, 3, the initial regulations must be tabled in Parliament, that's both houses, for approval by no later than 1st of December 2009, and must be approved by before the commencement of this Act, failing which they would have been deemed to have been approved by Parliament. So we put that in, giving us 5 months as Parliament to consider them. Those were not met. I'm not sure when these regulations were tabled. Does anyone know?
Last week,
okay. So instead of 5 months, 4 months, January, February, March, 4 months.
We have a month and a half.
Yeah, instead of 4 months, we've got a month and a half to approve them. Now, the directives, we also have to approve, and we haven't got them. The SAPS instructions must be submitted by the Cabinet Minister responsible for safety and security. They've got to be submitted to Parliament 30 days before they're issued. And the first national instructions must be submitted to Parliament before the commencement of the Act. We don't have them. Now, Number one, we got the regulations 2.5 months late. We need an explanation, a detailed explanation. The response from Mr. Bassett is vague. The NPA instructions, we don't have. We don't have any idea when they're coming. We need a detailed explanation as to what has happened. And then the SAPS, the SAPS would be for the police, and it's maybe something to liaise then with the chair of SAPS, the police committee.
We don't have
them either. They have to be submitted 30 days before approval. And what is worrying for me is that we were incredibly reasonable, I think, with the Act in terms of providing for implementation, or nearly 2 years to implementation. And it just seems to show that, well, you can't be reasonable. But I think what is of concern is that, you know, already before the Act has commenced, a provision has been broken. We put that in so we don't get rushed. We are now being rushed. We're going to be in the middle of the budget process. We should have considered these regulations in January when we had time, or before the budget process starts. We can't now. And we are in fact being told that look, there are other unforeseen problems, and it looks like the NPA are going to want the regulations changed. Why, we don't know, because we haven't even seen the directives. But really, it's totally out. I know that Mr. Bassett did. He's not the head of the department. So he's there may be other factors, and I don't want to sort of moan at the officials here. But just generally, as they're the representatives of the department here, it's totally unacceptable, and we need a proper explanation. And I think we need that explanation from the minister.
Thank you, Chair.
If you listen to the whole input,
because the assisting if your response takes the whole input into account, because it will facilitate how we interact with this whole process.
Thank you, Chair. I can understand the frustration, and I must apologize. As I said earlier, we did everything in our power, and I think Tanda Zulu is going to go into a bit more detail that you're requesting on the efforts that we put in to try and get these regulations here before the 1st of December. What I can undertake to do, Mr. Jeffries has indicated that the Minister should respond, we can table a document setting out in detail what we did, how we tried to meet the deadline, and table it, and we can get that to you within a day or two. Would the committee accept if Thunder Zulu just deals with the process, that'll give an idea of what efforts we did try and make to meet the deadline. Chair, my difficulty is that, and I'm not trying to stand out of the water, as far as the directives and the instructions and that sort of thing is concerned, the component that I work in hasn't been dealing with those things, because we basically just deal with the justice legislation, which is the justice regulations and the primary legislation. And I don't want to point fingers, but perhaps my colleagues from vulnerable groups, they have been coordinating and also having extreme difficult problems in getting inputs, but they've been sitting with the role-playing department in a committee, ICCJ, where all the departments sit together, and they've been trying to push for the directives and the national instructions and all the other processes and things that are necessary for the implementation of the Act. We haven't been part of that process. So, Chair, you were asking me to sort of try and deal with everything. Could I possibly...
Just a second. Maybe let's clear that part. I think what is reasonably expected is that the department knew that today it's late in terms of what is required. That written explanation you speak about, what one is not comfortable with, why would it come because this honourable member is expressing this concern? But the department came knowing that the requirements have not been met. So that is one issue. But what I'm interested in, we may spend time trying to find who is wrong and who is right, which is easy to find. This committee is not wrong. But somebody who is wrong must be in the department or NP or whatever. It's easy to find. But the point I'm trying to make is that I think the challenge we're facing is that I'm not sure about this, the strength of how, the, you know, if I use a legal term, is there something like that, Honorable Chair and other members? If it, our parameter is the directive to implement the act in a particular case, if it's got these defects, what is the relationship between these defects and the legality and that legal directive that it has to be implemented at a particular date? Can somebody assist? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, look, the Act says, Section 100, this Act is called the Child Justice Act and takes effect on the 1st of April 2010 or any earlier date fixed by the President by proclamation. So it could have been introduced earlier, it can't be introduced any later. Okay? And then the section I'm referring to, 98.3, says the initial regulations referred to in 97.1 must, so it's peremptory, it must be tabled in Parliament for approval by no later than 1st of December. So again, it could have been earlier, but not later. Now, I think for me there's two things. There's one is that it's extremely serious that that provision has not been complied with, which was peremptory. And the only thing we can do is, well, it's history, it hasn't been complied with. The implementation of the Act, we would have to amend it to say it doesn't get implemented. If the Act is not going to be implemented by the 1st of April, we would have to amend, we would have to have the Child Justice Amendment Bill to change that date to another date, 1st of July or whatever. So it's stuck. The issue is basically, I mean, I agree with you as you say, I'm sure everybody knew this issue was going to come up. They can't have expected us properly to be forming our jobs as MPs and oversight and just say, okay, fine, ooh, sorry, you've violated the Act already. Why is there not a better explanation? Why did the DG not come him herself to come and explain what had gone wrong? You know, are we being taken for granted? So for me, the first issue is that's happened. We need a decent, proper explanation from the proper sources. We can have from the department, but I think we need it at a more senior level. The second aspect is, this Act comes into effect on the 1st of April. What can we do to ensure that things are ready to implement it? We've got no choice in that matter. I for one, would totally oppose, as an individual, we haven't discussed it, but I mean, we gave 2 years for them to implement it. If people have to work through the night, so be it. But what can be done? So I think the crucial question is, sure, we've got the regulations, but what's happening with the NPA directive? We can't do much with the police because they don't fall under us, but we can on the NPA. Where are those directives? When are they coming? If we have to haul the head of the NPA here, then we must do that.
I think I would have the exact excuse either way. The cabinet we've got, we don't have multi-cabinet. We've got one cabinet. That cabinet is a common pool where all these things interact and where they are coordinated and aligned. So even on the SAPS one, there is no excuse. Unless we're saying our cabinet is non-functional, dysfunctional. In other words, there's no excuse. I think we have to look at the suggestions, what do we do under the circumstances. I think Honorable Jeff is actually hitting the nail on the head when he says, if you call this a justice, Child Justice Act, and you know the vulnerability of the objects of the bill, it has to be implemented if we can on the predetermined original what we call diet. But the challenge now that we are faced with, then what extraordinary things should be done to make it implementable. Now, we have got two approaches, two possibilities, or two scenarios that I want to table. Scenario one would be, we have them presenting here. We have them presenting here, whatever they are going to present, and set a deadline within which, because we cannot entertain in terms of taking decisions or doing anything. But for information purposes, we might have them presenting, although I'm not personally comfortable even with that. We can have them presenting and say, within this deadline, this explanation must have been given, and then all the necessary things that are supposed to be done in a short space of time to ensure that the bill is implemented by the first are done. And then let the plan to do those be in place, and let the plan be of such nature that it can be relied upon to help us believe that by the 1st of April the bill will be implemented. I've just thrown two scenarios on the table. I want the committee to assist.
Okay. I want to suggest that we do get the briefing. I don't think there's anything to be gained by not getting the briefing, and given that we're running out of time. So let's get the briefing on the regulations. Let's get the briefing as to where things are with the NTA directives, and then hear about the other departments. Because one of the problems with the bill and why so much time was given for implementation was it's the number of departments involved. Social developments come in as well. So I suggest we get that briefing. At least we know what is happening, and then we follow up the need for a proper response to why things are a proper formal response to why things are late.
So we do the briefing. Maybe so that we don't confuse issues. Let's do the briefing. At the end of the briefing, let's concretize the way forward with regard to both correction of issues and ensuring that we fall in time in terms of the implementation of the briefing. Let's make that the last element.
Yes. Chair, maybe one point just to say is this, and I don't know whether this was what we had intended or not. We can't amend regulations. They're the power of the minister. Our power is limited to, as Parliament, not as the committee. Well, we recommend to Parliament, to the National Assembly, to accept or reject. But what has happened before is that if we don't like something, we can say so. We can then persuade the minister to withdraw the regulations, put in the amendment that we want, retable it. And that has happened in the past. So what I'm just saying is I think we should also, when we get the briefing, see things in terms of actually we do have an informal power of amendment, not a formal one.
Thank
you. I don't want to call you the guilty. Lead us in an extraordinary manner. Thank you,
Chair. Can I just respond?
I agree with you that the provision, shortly, we need to all to be taken on part, regulations and all other stories.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I'm going to hand over to my colleagues to deal with the Act, a broad overview of the Act and the regulations, and then if I may, I'll hand over to Ms. Moodley and to Ms. Cook. If I can just...
We don't have the copy of this Act here.
Very thick.
Yeah.
I
think that was 15. But guys, can we do this? Can we do this? No. Can we learn this practice? That if we are going to have a meeting, all the relevant documents that are going to be of significance should naturally be available. I don't think we should come here and ask for those documents. I'm talking now to our support team. I hope we'll actually start that in the future. Because clearly this thing was last dealt with in 2008, naturally. I think it's a logical fact that those documents are supposed to be here. Present. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. We have distributed one document. It's in table form. It just sets out the provisions of the Act which require regulations. And then in the second column, I think it's given an idea of what the regulations need to deal with. So that's just for your benefit. The regulations themselves have been circulated. They were tabled. I'm going to hand over to my colleagues to do the briefing. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just to give some background, I think to a great extent what part of the introduction has been already discussed here. Just to try and soften the blow, it's true that the Portfolio Committee did approve the bill in June, but unfortunately it only was finally approved towards the end of 2008, I think the late November, because of changes proposed by the Select Committee, that is my information. And because of the substantial changes adjusted to the bill, the translation into the Setswana version of the bill really took a lot of time, and hence the President signed the bill into law in May 2009, and it was published in the Gazette on the 11th of May. Now, as has already been indicated, 1 April is the date, but now the proposed date of implementation of the Act, and our Minister is required to make regulations, and as has already been indicated, the Act empowers the Minister to make the regulations only after consultation with a lot of Ministers, except in the case where Section 98.3 of the Act is concerned, where we have to make the regulations in consultation with the Minister of Home Affairs insofar as the registration of the birth date of a child is concerned, and that's now a child in respect of whom age determination has been made. Now, yes, we were fully aware of the time frames in the Act, and namely 1 December, but for reasons, as Lauren said, really beyond our control, we were unable to meet the deadline, and Tando will in her presentation when she deals with the process of consultation in detail also speak to that. Now, if I can just quickly brief them, the committee, or give them a broad overview of the Act, I would just like first to focus on the object of the Act, and that will also make it easier for the members when we deal later with the regulations to really understand where that thing fits in. First of all, it's the establishment of a criminal justice system for children who are in conflict in the law, but in accordance with the values of the Constitution and international obligations. The Act also wants to promote the spirit of Ubuntu in the criminal justice system. The Act also provides for the minimum age of criminal capacity of children and to provide for mechanisms how to deal with children who lack criminal capacity. And criminal capacity, I think, in layman's terminology, means minimum age of criminal capacity. When can you really, in terms of the law, hold a child liable for his or her actions? And then also to make specific provisions for securing the attendance of children at court and for their release. And I think you might have picked up in the Act that in all events you try to avoid that a child is detained in prison and be released as soon as possible. Very importantly also to make provision for the assessment of children by probation officers. So when it comes to the court, the case or the matter, then really the presiding officer knows, you're always in a position to know what the personal circumstances of this child is. Then also to provide for the holding of a preliminary inquiry, and I think this is important so that we can ensure that you know exactly within the criminal justice system what is the background of the child, so being able to decide whether the matter should be formally tried in the manner that we are used to or not. And then also to have what we call child justice courts to hear all trials of children. But just to pass here to say is, if we say child justice court, we don't really mean a separate court or what. It's a magistrate's court or a high court, but where specific provisions or procedures apply where we deal with or when we deal with children. and then also to extend the sentencing options that are available to children and to go beyond the normal life imprisonment and fines, etc. And I will talk about that later. And then also just the one very important thing is to entrench the notion of restorative justice in the criminal justice system. And later when we discuss the restorative justice sentences and examples, you will be able to understand that as well. So in general, we can say that the Act applies to a child who was under the age, or a person who was under the age of 10 years when the crime was committed. That is the first thing. And secondly, a child who was 10 years or older, but less than 18 years when he or she was called to appear at the preliminary inquiry. Now, of course, there's always an exception, and that is that the Act may also apply to a person who is alleged to have committed an offence when he or she was under the age of 18 years, but is 18 years and older, but less than 21, when the person is called upon to appear in the preliminary inquiry. Just so to show to you, there are instances that a person that are over the age of 18 will also have the benefit of the law. Now, the Act provides what we believe a nice roadmap regarding the manner in which a child is to be handled. Of course, the child only who has been alleged to have committed an offence. And this roadmap is really linked first of all to the age of the child, and you will see when I categorize the provisions of the Act, you will be able to follow that. And secondly, also in regard to the seriousness of the offences. Now, the seriousness of the offences, as you can detect at the end of the Act, there are schedules. There are actually three schedules that speak to different offences. The one being Schedule 1, which contains the least serious offences, and it goes more serious and more serious when you get to Schedule 3. Like, for instance, murder and rape will fall under Schedule 3, whereas Schedule 1 is plain common assault, excrimining urea, it's less than 2,500 rand. Now, as I indicated, really the Act is a roadmap, and for purposes of this presentation, I think we can try and categorize the provisions of the Act into three categories. The one is children under the age of 10 years, where the Act is really trying to take away or take the child out of the criminal justice system, because this child will in any event not be able to be prosecuted, because as I said, such a child doesn't have a criminal capacity to be held responsible for his or her behavior. So the child will be dealt with outside the criminal justice system. What will happen? A police officer will refer the child to a probation officer. The probation officer will assess the child, and then the probation officer will decide how to deal with the child. The probation officer may, for instance, decide to refer the child to the children's court, and the children's court will mainly deal with children in need of care and protection. So then it's our Act will not apply. If they will follow the procedures in the Children's Act and the regulations. The probation officer may wish to refer the child for counselling and therapy or for support services, like, for instance, to get somebody to assist the child doing the homework. That was a nice example that I got from our colleague. And then also to decide this is not serious, it was really just like an experiment from the child, and to say I'm not going to take any action at all. So that is how child under the age of 10 can be dealt with. Then we have another category, that is a child over the age of 10 years, but less than or under the age of 14 years. Now, this child, the child who falls under this category is alleged in terms of the Act, or was alleged to have committed an offence in terms of the Act, is presumed to lack criminal capacity. And the state has now, for this category of children, has to prove beyond reasonable doubt that this child has criminal capacity. I think the interesting thing is you look at the child in front of you, not at the age group, but the state must be able to prove that this specific child understands and knows and can take responsibility for his or her act. Now, and if the state fails to prove this criminal capacity, then the child is dealt with as if the child is under the age of 10 years. when you go to the probation officer, and the probation officer will deal with the child. So that was the second category. The third category is where you get the children over the age of 10, but in respect of whom the state has been able to prove that they have criminal capacity, as well as children in general over the age of 40. So in this regard, I would like just to highlight the following three stages that I think we can identify in the Act. The first is assessment. As I already explained to you, a probation officer is responsible for the assessment of the child, and every child who is alleged to have committed an offence must be assessed by a probation officer. Yes, of course, there are certain exceptions, but this is the basic rule. And on being informed by a police officer that the child has been served with a written warning and a summons and or have been arrested, the probation officer must assess the child within a specific time period that is in the Act already. And the purpose of this assessment is to establish whether this child is not a child in need of care and protection, and hence that the possibility that the child can be referred to the children's court. Secondly, to establish what is the prospect of diversion of the matter when you deal with another way, and we will later also give you examples of what are the diversion options. And then also to estimate the age of a child if the age is uncertain. We know what is the practical reality. There are a number of children without birth certificates and that, and for the assessment will serve that purpose as well. And then also to formulate recommendations regarding the release or detention and placement of the child. Very important, because as I've explained, is we don't want to detain the children in police cells or lock-off. Then the second phase is from assessment you move to preliminary inquiry, and I think this is a completely new aspect of the law here, where when we have a preliminary inquiry, it's presided over, let's say, by a magistrate or a judge. What is important here is to say that the preliminary inquiry is very informal. It's an informal procedure, it's like a pre-trial procedure, and it's inquisitorial in nature, which means actually the magistrate must try and intervene, whereas opposed to in normal criminal cases, it's like I sit back, more back, and I listen to you. So, and one of the objectives of the preliminary inquiry is then to look at the assessment report of the probation officer and just to establish whether the matter may be diverted or not. Not diverted means then you go to the formal court procedures where there is a trial. Now, then also what is important is the diversion aspect that I referred you to. Before dealing with the trial, and I just want to make then a few observations about diversion. Diversion is one of the central few features of the new criminal justice system. It involves dealing with the child also outside the formal criminal justice system, but it does so through programs designed to promote the reintegration of the child into the family and community. And you will see all in the Act there is many references to this rehabilitative aspect, trying to reintegrate the child into the family and the community. Now, the diversion options are set out in two levels. Level 1 diversion option applies to the less serious offences in Schedule 1, to which I've already talked to, like theft, criminal area, etc. And the Level 1 diversion option includes things like a written apology or an oral apology. The child can be referred to counselling or therapy, but there's a lot of examples in the Act, but this is just by way of explanation. Then the Level 2 diversion option applies to the more serious offences, and those are offences that you get in Schedules 2 and 3. And as I indicated to you, Level 2 of Schedule 2 offences is like a robbery where there's no violence, there's no guns involved, etc. And also the more serious cases of theft and malicious damage to property, outbreaks. And then also, of course, in respect of Schedule 3 offences, which is the more serious offences, the murder, sedition, kidnapping and rape. Now, the level 2 diversion option includes compulsory attendance of a specific center or place, which may include temporary residence or placement under supervision of a probation officer. And the diversion options can, of course, also be used in combination with the different possibilities. And then also, I think what's important for you to know is that the Act provides for the accreditation of diversion programs and diversion service providers, and you will see the regulations talk to that as well. And the thing is that if you divert a child to an accredited diversion program, it must be through an order of court. It's not just that, you know, the prosecutor or whoever can decide this is the way to go. Now, if I can just give you a briefing quickly on the trial in the Child Justice Court. I was also asking myself, but what is different? And just to maybe quickly just to tell you what I believe is the most important things about being different now for a child vis-a-vis what will happen after the 1st of April is really the question of, let's say, forced legal representation, in the sense of there must always be a legal, an attorney or an advocate to be there to assist either the child in him or herself, or to assist the court in dealing with the matter. I think another important thing that can be highlighted is the court, before the plea is taken down or given, the court must explain certain issues to the child. Like, for instance, what is the child's right, and also what is the procedure that can be expected. I think that is very important just to take note of. And then, as I indicated, what matters will land in the trial justice court are the matters that have not been diverted during the preliminary inquiry, but importantly, enough to mention that even during the case, but just before the state has closed its case, even the trial justice court can also still decide to divert the matter. Now, a child who has not been diverted will be tried and convicted and sentenced. Let us just look at the objectives of sentencing a child. First of all, it's to encourage the child to understand the implications of and be accountable for the harm caused, to promote an individualized response which strikes this balance between the circumstances of the child in front of the judge or the magistrate, the nature of the offense, and the interests of society. And as I've already indicated, the idea is really to reintegrate the child into the family and the community. And then also we must remember that the idea behind the Act is really to use imprisonment as a form of sentence, as a measure of last resort, and then if it's that unavoidable for the shortest period of time. Now, the kind of sentences that you can expect to see in the Act is a community-based sentence, where you don't take the child out of the community, but the court will make certain orders to say it's from now on you must attend a particular school, or you must, for instance, report to a specific person so that person can really supervise the child's behavior. That is when we refer to community-based sentence, what we mean. Restorative justice is really where with about the victim and the child, and how you can restore that relationship, what kind of compensation can be paid, if I remember correctly, to the victim, etc. And then the third one is the compulsory residence in a child and a youth care center. And I think it's just important to know that the child and youth care center aspects are also, to a great extent, if I'm correct to say, regulated in the Children's Act. And that's why you will see there's always like a reference to our Act, the Children's Act, and then also, of course, the Criminal Procedure Act. So, what is also important, I think, when you look at the regulations, then to have at the back of your mind this view that it's our Act, it's the Children's Act, as I said, it's the Criminal Procedure Act, but as Honourable Member John Jeffrey said, then you have the directive by the prosecutor, the head of the prosecutorial authority that will deal with prosecutions. Then you have, in addition to that, the national instructions where the police will explain, you know, fill the gaps in where the regulations don't go far enough in so far as arrest, for instance, is concerned, to tell the police exactly what to do in what circumstance. Then you have a national policy framework that must be developed by our department, and that is to coordinate and to make sure that there's application of policy. A national policy. And then the last policy that I'm aware of is the one by the Minister of Social Development. That is also a policy, but that's more in line with some secondly, the diversion options, etc. So there are so many other things or measures or directives or frameworks within which we have to look at the regulations and when the act and the regulations and everything would be applied. And then I think what is also important, and to some extent Mr. Jeffries has alluded to that, is there's a lot of fallback positions in the Act, one of which was the issue if Parliament hasn't approved the regulations to state deem. But in regard to a number of the sections as well, if, for instance, there's no way in which a assessment of by the probation officer could have been done, then there's always this kind of, you know, it's the interest of justice, so call it, and it will prejudice the child, then this and that can be done. And we know that Parliament really tried to ensure that there are these kind of aspects. One thing that, of course, is important because of the relationship between our Act and the Children's Act, that it's also important that the Children's Act commence on the 1st of April. Otherwise, we will have together with this. Yeah. I know that there are certain sections of that Act is in operation, but I don't think that is really the sections that have a bearing so much directly on the section in our Act. And I would like to pause there, and Sandra will then just speak to you on the consultation process, what we've done, and I trust that through that also the committee members will have some understanding of the difficulties that we encounter. Thank you.
Well, can I take this opportunity to welcome the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Police, Honorable Chikung. Thanks for joining us. We feel more complete. I wish social service and anybody else would have been here. We are more courageous together. And can you proceed?
Thank you, Chair. In going through the discussion of the regulation, I will just start by the consultation. As it has been already indicated, that our minister is required to make the regulation in consultation with various other ministers which are listed in the Act. So while it was the responsibility of the department, it was its primary responsibility to draft the regulation, because the implementation of the Act and the regulation cuts across the range of other departments. The department had to consult the drafting of the latest regulations required extensive consultation with other role players, because the legislation has a significant impact on the functions of the other departments. So the department began the process of drafting the regulation as early as November 2008, just after the bill was approved by Parliament. This was still in the process of, the department was still in the process of trying to translate the bill, as Ina had already indicated, to Setswana. So we began the process of consultation, bilateral discussion with other departments, the relevant departments such as the Police Services and the Department of Social Development, around November, December 2008. And this was just to go through the Act to identify the sections that require legislation and which have an impact on that particular department that we met with. And then this bilateral discussion was then followed up by a written request from our Director General to his counterparts, requesting them to give us written inputs and comments on the matters relating that require regulation but relating to their areas of responsibility. These letters were sent to the other departments in March 2009, and the departments were requested to give us their input around beginning of April 2009. The responses received from other departments required more and direct and continued interventions with other departments so as to clarify the issues involved. The department nevertheless continued with the drafting process of the regulation. So the first draft of the regulation was finalized in August 2009. And then the department published a notice in the Gazette in August 2009 inviting the public to make comments on the draft regulation. And in addition to that, we also sent specific invitations to all the relevant departments and including civil organization groups, especially those who were part of the deliberations during the deliberations of the bill in Parliament. So we also specifically sent letters to them, inviting them to comment on the draft, first draft of the regulation. And they were requested to give us their input by the 18th of September 2009. A number of departments submitted their comments and the NGOs as well. Some of them met the deadline, the 18th of September, but some only gave us their inputs after that date. Some of the written inputs that we received were not very clear, so it was also necessary again to have bilateral meetings with the relevant departments to clarify issues. Many of the comments that we received, we obviously incorporated it into the final draft that is before the committee now, and some of which we could not comment, but we tried to meet with the relevant departments to clarify those positions. And those that we couldn't incorporate was because of the practices or because of the requirements of the Act, the enabling legislation, and because of the existing practice and practical considerations. Now, because the Act requires the minister to consult the other ministers, it was necessary for the minister to send letters to ask relevant ministers that he had to consult with sending them the draft regulations to have their comments. And this was done in November 2009. The ministers were requested to provide us input around 13 November. We understood that it was a short-lived deadline, but it was an attempt to meet the first the deadline that is set in the Act, which is submission of the draft regulations to Parliament by the 1st of December. And we also were taking into consideration that we had consulted with the department during the drafting process. A few requests were received from the other departments to extend the deadline. And although the majority of the cabinet members supported the draft regulation, some confirmed the comments that were made by the department earlier, and the department consultation, which could not be accommodated. I should also mention that the regulation were discussed to some extent with the ICCJ, which has been highlighted earlier. Which is coordinated and shared by the our colleagues from the Chief Directorate Vulnerable Groups. This is the group where all European departments are represented, and also the NGOs, especially those who are part of the process. Because of the significant role played by the NGOs community during the promotion of the legislation in Parliament, we also played great reliance on their representative inputs and comments on the drafting of the regulation. It is our understanding that the NGOs that were involved have no problem with the draft regulation because we have tried to accommodate almost most of their inputs. So we are under the understanding that they support the regulations that are before the committee now. The NGOs that were part of the drafting process and that we consulted with during the drafting process. Now, because the regulation must be formulated in line with the framework provided in the principal act, in the act, and specific enabling provisions, some of the changes proposed by commentators along the way could not be entertained. And I will just mention quite a few of those. When we send out the regulation for public comment, the South African Human Rights Commission indicated that the provisions of the Act and the draft regulations relating to the transporting of the children with adults and girls with boys are not in line with Section 28 of the Constitution and also with the Convention of the Convention on the Rights of a Child. In terms of the Constitution and these are the other instruments, a child that is deprived of its liberty must be separated from others in terms of transporting or in terms of being held in the cell. This issue was also debated. The committee members that were here during the process of the deliberation remember that this issue was also deliberated at length when the bill was processed in Parliament. And both parliamentary committees came to the conclusion that because of the financial implications and human resource constraints and the distance that is involved in some other parts of the country, it may be practically impossible for the Act to comply with the Constitution and the international instrument in this regard. So it was therefore provided in the Act that the child, as a general rule, must be transported separately. But then as an exception, if it is impossible to do so, the police official may transport a child with an adult. But then the Act puts a proviso that if this happens, the police officer must submit a written report to the presiding officer explaining why the child was transported with an adult. That is the comment or the concern that was raised by the South African Human Rights Commission. And then the Magistrate Commission, they pointed out that there appeared to be an anomaly between Section 58 and 59, Section 58 and 79 of the Act, in that in failure to comply with the diversion order in terms of Section 58 attracts a warrant of arrest or the issue of summons, while in case of a failure to comply with a sentence, which is heavier in terms of Section 79, the child must only be brought before a child justice court. And the Commission was of the view that the measures in Section 58, which require the presiding officer to issue summons or a warrant of arrest, are a little bit harsh and a drastic step due to the fact that children often fail to comply with diversion orders because of the lack of means, often transport money for transport to travel to where they have to attend diversion programs. Okay, that was the concern raised by the Magistrate Commission. And then there was another concern raised by another section within the department, the section that deals with the expungement of records. The concern was that the department which deals with the expungement of criminal records in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act, in its comment proposed that Section 87 of the Act, which deals with the expungement of the records of a child, and Section 271B of the Criminal Procedure Act, which also deals with expungement, but in case of an adult, to be amended to provide in the Criminal Procedure Act for a single process for the expungement of all criminal records, both for the child and the adult. They also proposed that the criteria used in determining whether or not to expunge a criminal record should be the same.
Okay. Are we able to comment? I have to ask the team something which I was saying. Can I?
I think my proposal is that just allow the question to finish. It's almost there. And then we can get to what has happened. It was a background in the provision.
Yeah.
And then now it is a process of consultation with the stakeholders around the regulation. I would prefer if it were to be efficient sometimes, but we don't have only to be efficient. Just allow me to.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. I was saying that the directorate that did the expungement also proposed that the criteria used in determining whether or not to expunge the criminal record should be the same for an adult and for a child, namely that the seriousness of an offence is determined in relation to the type of the offence, as it is the case in Section 271 or B of the Criminal Procedure Act, and not to the nature of the offence as classified in terms of the schedule, in terms of the Child Justice Act and as proposed in Section 87 of the Act. Another concern they raised relates to the fact that offences mentioned in the schedules are linked to the value or the weight. And it was indicated that this might be difficult to consider because some applicants are as to the value of or the weight is often not reflected in the charge sheet or in the criminal records received from the criminal records center. So it would be difficult for them to be able to say whether the offence is a Schedule 1 offence or a Schedule 2 offence because the value or the weight of the item is not indicated. I must, however, mention that it was agreed that these issues will be monitored as the Act is implemented to see whether it is really a big problem or not. Can I just continue to say that a minimalistic approach was followed in preparing the draft regulations, and the provision was only made to issues requiring regulations to be prescribed in terms of the Act, as indicated or contained in the list that has been circulated. An attempt has also been made not to over-regulate issues, but to allow some form of flexibility to ensure that different scenarios not often foreseen can be accommodated, and also that functionaries can deal with issues administratively and that procedures can be adjusted quickly to fit the changes or new circumstances without having to amend the regulations. The idea was also not to rehash what is in the Act and to duplicate the administrative procedures that are already in existence. There are a number of sections in the Act which require us to require the making of the regulations in respect of more or less the same issue. Where it was possible, attempts were made to use the same wording to ensure consistency and uniformity between the Act and the regulation. The chapters, we also tried to the extent possible to align the chapters in the regulations to the chapters in the Act. That's almost about it on the issue of the consultation.
Who is going to take us through the regulations? You. Oh. Okay. Abhijit?
The issue around Section 58 and 79, I don't quite understand what the magistrates are on about. Because...
Can you hold that?
Yeah.
I request strongly. Is anyone ready to brief us with regulation? You know, I think I understand the point. You were saying the responses in dealing with the deviations in those areas, those two sections.
Well, Chair, it's a problem that they seem to have with the Act rather than the regulations. So I would suggest that we deal with it now. But I mean, the way I read it is that 58 is about diversions before it gets to trial and nothing to do with the magistrate. Not nothing to do with the magistrate. They're primarily in the responsibility of the prosecutor. And the magistrate conducts an inquiry as to whether the failure to comply was the child's fault. So if it's a thing as mentioned that they didn't have money to get to the place of diversion, then I would have seen that's not their fault. If it is determined as not being their fault, there's various consequences that apply, and that's largely up to the prosecutor.
So I'm not sort of quite sure what they were on about. And then also I had a little bit of a problem the other bit I got up around the transporting of children being, you know, contrary to the Constitution. Which section of the Constitution is that specifically?
You know what I'm worried about? What I'm worried about, if this is the briefing about what ensued during consultation with stakeholders and what emerged there and what exactly is being tabled, it would be better interacted with, in my view, if they have actually briefed us with that recall, with the regulations. It's my proposal. My worry is that if you deal with the Act now, once we're dealing with the regulations, once we have not finished regulations, we might be moving in between and end up not finishing pressing on regulations. Can we pack that? Can we pack that if that's the right thing?
I'm not sure then why we got briefed on things to do with the Act.
My understanding is that naturally, if you speak about regulations, regulations are from the Act. So naturally, you will be speaking about the Act in the process. But the point I'm requesting is that while those issues were going to be entertained, can we allow them just to finish?
So you can pass the answer. Can someone take us through regulations?
You were dealing with the process of consultation,
am I correct? Who is going to take us through a quick. Yeah. But pass the. Well, you came with that, and I think that's what some of them responded to.
Thank you, Chair. As I indicated before,
my worry is that what you presented, you don't have much enough. You don't have a copy of what you're presenting. Yeah, it's able to.
We did think about that. What we can do is make this document available. We can do it.
After the act, after this process. It becomes useless. There was also the link 20 minutes for quality and effective interaction. And if it's not here, we'll end up having that to save this situation.
On the analysis of the draft of the regulation itself, as I indicated before, we tried to follow the same sequence or chapters as it is in the Act. So chapter 1 of the regulation deals with the general provision.
Are you presenting this?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, chapter 1 of the regulation deals with the general provision. That will be regulation 1, which is just the definitions, and we've tried to limit the definitions because the definitions we follow in the regulations is the definitions in the Act. So we only defined in the regulations what is not defined in the Act that we feel that should be defined in the regulations. And then regulation 2 deals with the designation of probation officers. And I must mention that this one is, there is no enabling provision in the Act, but it was requested by the South African Police Services that in order to make the implementation easier for them, because they are required always to, when arresting a child or serving a summons or written notice, to notify the probation officer. So they should at least have a central point where they know that they will submit the notification to. Then they requested that we include this regulation for the designation of a probation officer for particular police station or police stations to whom the police officer will submit the notification.
Chair, any comment?
Yeah. No, I just wondered whether there shouldn't be a time period within which the Director General of Social Development must do this designation. So you don't have a situation where, quite frankly, you have police stations without probation officers. And then maybe also there should be a requirement that the Director General of Social Development must ensure that this list is updated. Is kept up to date. There is a requirement that he must inform the National Commission of any changes of the particulars, but it just is so easy invariably you will find that police stations do not have probation officers, or if they've got a probation officer allocated, that probation officer left 6 months ago. So it was just a suggestion that we maybe look at that. If the regulations are going to be withdrawn and we can amend, then maybe we should have a time period, must within 3 months of the coming into effect of these regulations, ensure that there's a probation officer designated for each station, and then a further sub one must apply his or her mind. Sorry, must ensure that the list is updated regularly, and the two remains as it is.
How many
couples
do we have here, ma'am? Can I again appeal to members that at least present the chapter and finish it? If we want to interact, we interact with that chapter, not one regulation. Proceed. Finish chapter 2.
Chapter 2 deals with the criminal capacity of a child under the age of 14 years and the matters related to age. Section 9 of the Act, the members will see that in the list that has been circulated around, requires the minister to prescribe the manner in which a police official should hand over a child who is under the age of 10 years or does not have criminal capacity and therefore cannot be prosecuted to his or her parents or appropriate adult or guardian or to child and youth care center. And then Regulation 3 deals with the handing over of a child, and it sets out in detail what the obligation of a police officer when handing over the child, including that the police officer must, after explaining everything to the child, also hand over an information note to the person who is to receive the child, which information note must contain information provided in the regulation. The emphasis on Regulation 3 is to the use of language, the language that the police officials use when handing over and dealing with the child and the person to whom the child is handed to. And the age, the police official must take into consideration the age and the maturity of the child and try to give sufficient information and verify with the child and the person whether they understand the information. The police official must also make sure that the person who is to receive the child is aware of the responsibilities of receiving the child and then is willing to be able to accept the child and to ensure that the responsibilities are carried on. Regulation 3 also contains a further obligation relating to the manner in which a police official must conduct himself or herself, which aims to achieve the object of the Act and which is also more child friendly. The aim is to urge the police official to deal with a child in a very sensitive way. And then Section 9 also requires the police official of the fact that a child who has been handed over and indicate to whom the child was handed over to notify the probation officer of the fact that the child has been handed over and to whom the child was handed over. And then Regulation 4 indicates how a police official should do this so that the probation officer can access the child and take a decision as to how to deal with the child, and which also links with Section 9.3. Section 9.3 requires or enables the probation officer to assess the child and then to take certain action. Remember, this is a child under the age of 10 years who cannot be prosecuted. So the child does not go through the criminal justice system. The child is referred to the probation officer and dealt with by the probation officer. So
So Section 9.3 provides that the child may be referred to a children's court, the child may be referred for counseling or therapy or accredited program. So regulation 6 to 11 deals with the manner in which the probation officer must refer the child to any of the processes listed in Section 9.3. It provides that the probation officer may, in the prescribed manner, arrange for support services for a child, arrange a meeting with the parents and the child, arrange for services or assistance, or decide to take no action. In pursuance to Section 9.3 of the Act, Regulation 5.11, as indicated, contains the manner in which the probation officer should go about doing this. For purposes of support services, we have tried to link this with the Regulation 2, which deals with the designation of a probation officer, that the designated probation officer must compile a database of services that are available, so that every time the probation officer is to refer a child to support services, there is a database that is available where they can refer the child. Section 9.6 of the Act provides for the probation officer to record, after assessing the child, to record the outcome of the assessment. And then the section require the minister to prescribe the manner in which the probation officer must record the assessment, the outcome of the assessment, and the decision. Regulation 12 then deals with how the probation officer should go about recording the assessment and the decision. And then Section 11 of the Act, this is the section that deals with the evaluation of criminal capacity of a child. Remember, we said that a child who is 10 years but under the age of 14 years is presumed to lack criminal capacity until the state proves beyond reasonable doubt that the child has criminal capacity. So Section 11 requires the minister to prescribe regulation in terms of which the child justice court may refer a child for the evaluation of criminal capacity. And then regulation 13 sets out the manner in which such an order or a referral should be done. And we have actually designed a form in terms of regulation 15, which is in a form of an order that will be filled in and signed by the magistrate, and then the child is referred to the person who will do the criminal evaluation. Going further, section 13 and 14 of the Act covers the issue of the age determination. And Section 13 is the age determination by a probation officer during the assessment. And the section requires also the minister to prescribe a form in which the probation officer will do the assessment of the age of the child. So we have prescribed a form in terms of that, which is Form 3. And Section 14 provides for a court, a child justice court or any court, to also to make age estimation of a child. And the section requires the minister to prescribe the manner in which the age estimation is done by the court. So we have also designed a form, which is Form 4 in terms of Regulation 14, on how the child is referred to a medical practitioner by the court in order for the estimation of the age. That is Chapter 2, which deals with the criminal capacity and the issues related to age.
Members want to comment on Chapter 2.
Criminal capacity estimation, age estimation.
Okay, Chapter 3 deals with the method of bringing a child to attend the preliminary inquiry. Section
sections 18 to 20 of the Act provides for a written summons, a written notice summons or the arrest for as a method to bring a child to attend a preliminary inquiry. And a police officer is required in terms of this provision when handing a written notice or serving a summons or arresting a child to in the prescribed manner to inform the child and the parent of certain issues and to explain them the certain issues in terms of the Act and to warn the child and the parent. So regulations as 16, 17, and 18 deal with that, the manner in which a police officer should explain the issues that I explained in the Act to the child, the manner in which the police officer should inform and warn the child. And again, the emphasis is on the language that is to be used by the police officer, and the emphasis is also on the police officer to take into account the age and the maturity of the child.
Any comment on chapter 3? Chapter 4?
Chapter 4 deals with the release or the detention and placement of
On chapter 3, if I'm not asking an outside question, do you have any services of the forensic psychologist in this project?
I think it will apply in terms of section 11, where the child is referred for the evaluation of criminal capacity. Okay, chapter 4 deals with the release, detention or placement of a child prior to the sentence or prior to attending a preliminary inquiry. Section 22 of the Act provides that where a child has not been released before his or her first appearance at a preliminary inquiry, a police officer must provide the inquiry magistrate with a written report in the prescribed manner, giving reasons why the child was not released. So Regulation 19 sets out what should be contained in the report, which includes, among other things, the reason why the child was not released and full particulars of the attempts that were made by the police official to locate the parent, appropriate adult, or guardian. And Section 24 of the Act provides that the presiding officer may, if a child after being released by a presiding officer at a preliminary inquiry or child justice court fails to appear at the inquiry or court or fails to comply with the conditions of release. If the presiding officer is informed of this, the presiding officer must, in the prescribed manner, issue a warrant of arrest or cause someone to be issued to bring the child to appear in court. Then Regulation 20 of the Trust Regulations deals with this aspect. For the purposes of this, an affidavit and supporting documents are required, which may be submitted in different ways to the investigating police official or to the clerk of the court. Then Section 28 of the Act provides that if a child in detention complains or launches a complaint about an injury or any other trauma that the child may have suffered to any person, the complaint must be in the prescribed manner, be recorded and reported to the station commissioner. Then Regulation 21 provides the manner in which this complaint must be recorded and reported. Regulation 21 provides that the complaint must be recorded in a form of a report, and we set out in Regulation 21 what should be contained in the report. It also provides certain detail as to what must be recorded in the register for the child detained as referred to in Section 28(3) of the Act. Provisions are also made for the details of providing in the report by the station commissioner in respect of his or her finding. The regulation also indicates that the station commissioner must refer refer the report to the National Commissioner, and the National Commissioner may issue instruction on how the matter should be handled. Section 28 of the Act further requires each station commissioner to keep a register, that register with prescribed details regarding the detention of a child at the police station. The section provides that the register must be examined by any person as prescribed. And then Regulation 22 speaks to that. Regulation 22 regulates the details, the content, and the persons that may examine such the register. It is important to note that access to the register is divided into two categories. The regulation provides for direct access to the register insofar as officials in the exercise of their duty is concerned, and any other person who wishes to access that register may do so by a written request to the station commissioner concerned. And then Section 29 of the Act provides for factors to be taken into account by a presiding officer when deciding whether or not to place a child in a child and youth care center. For this purpose, the presiding officer may request a functionary responsible for the management of the child and youth care center to furnish a prescribed sworn statement in respect of the availability of the accommodation in that center and the level of security and the amenities in that center. Regulation 22 speaks to that. It prescribes the form that may be filled in, which is in the form of an affidavit, a sworn statement, which may be completed by the functionary and then submitted to court. Section 21 of the Act provides that where the court has made an error regarding the placement of the child must be referred back to the presiding officer in a prescribed manner. So Regulation 24 speaks to that. Regulation 24 regulates how a child should be referred back to the presiding officer. In essence, it provides that referral must be done in writing, must contain certain details, and must be handed to the presiding officer. I must also indicate that we have tried to regulate on who will be responsible for transporting the child from where the child is placed back to court. Section 33 of the Act provides for a situation where a police official is unable to transport a child separately from adults. The Act requires the police official to submit a written report to a presiding officer stating the reasons why the child was not transported separately. And then Regulation 25 deals with that. It regulates the contents of that report that must be submitted by a police official to the presiding officer. And details include the reasons why the child was not transported separately, and it also the report must also include attempts that were made by the police official to try to transport the child separately from adults.
Any comment on chapter 4?
Right.
The hands are flying. What's happening in chapter 4? All right, well, Jeff, Prof.
Sorry, sir, I thought it was wrong. The comment on chapter 1. Mm-hmm. It's not just feeling. I wanted to comment on chapter 1.
No,
my comment on chapter 1.
And left side is not communicated proper. I was asking, but there's no problem. No, there are no military restrictions. Our approach has been that if there's no comment in chapter 2, we'll go on. But if there are serious issues, we'll come back there. Honorable Chair, what do you mean with chapter 4?
Chapter 4. Regulation 21, the complaint about injury or trauma of the child in detention. I'm surprised that, I mean, it's very much a belt and braces thing, but you haven't really dealt much with the issue of medical examination. The Act is basically the Act sort of is relatively prescriptive about when the person must have a medical treatment, sort of four categories. There's nothing in the regulations. The regulations are a factual thing.
the particulars of the medical treatment received by the child, if any. There's nothing about whether, you know, the station commissioner having to record why he or she decided not to send the if the, I would have thought something like a regulation, and did you look at this? If if the child complains about a what's the name of the section? If the child complains about an injury, then and the commissioner decides, station commissioner decides not to send the child for medical treatment, the station commissioner should put out the reasons why. Because you're not actually guiding the station commissioners at all. And you could then find a thing of a child in police custody complains, you know, they say they were beaten up, they said they had bruises, and the station commissioner just, you know, doesn't feel obliged to you know, I think if there's evidence of physical injury, it's a requirement that they get sent. But I just think, did you look at the fact of requiring the station commissioner, let's say the child says, "I there were clearly bruises, there was evidence of the injury." In the regulations, there's nothing that the station commissioner has to put down to say whether, why he or she didn't send them for treatment. Have you looked at that aspect? The other one was, I don't know, and Chair, I don't know if you Ms. Chikunga came while I was out. I don't know if you acknowledged her.
I did.
Oh, okay. But I mean, I don't know if she's got comments on these points, particularly with regarding the police. Then the access to the register. You know, we had a big issue around generally the whole thing of you know, yeah, access to the children. You've got the parent of the child or the appropriate adult or guardian. And now you've got nothing for siblings. Sure, they've then got to go for the, they've got to ask permission of the station commissioner. But I don't know if that's, I can't remember how we dealt with it. We dealt with it elsewhere in the Act. Are they not appropriate adults? Did we cover it in that regard? But my worry is if you specify, you do have appropriate adults in the, in the regulations, but if I remember right, appropriate adult was defined as including a sibling, wasn't it? And if you don't have it in the regulations, then the police are going to get, appropriate adult means any member of the child's family, including a sibling who's 16 years or older. My worry is if you give this to the police, as is, Chikunda may disagree with me, the 16-year-old sibling comes along and says, "I want to look at the register." And the police officer says, "Hey, you're not an adult." No way. Because they're not going to go and check, read, the regulation should be self-containing. They're not going to go and look at the definition of appropriate adult in the Act. They're going to look at what's here. Whereas, in fact, the 17-year-old sibling is entitled. So it's not particularly, you've gone for belt and braces, but you're assuming the police officials will read the Act, which they won't necessarily. And in a situation like that, they'll say to the 17-year-old, or they may say to the 17-year-old, "No, you're not the parent, and you're not an adult. Goodbye." Whereas, in fact, they're entitled in terms of the Act to look at the register.
What I'm curious about in Regulation 21, Honourable Chief, is that before they respond, is that I'm not sure whether we are sure of the adequacy or the nature of the report and the extent to which it could provide information about variety of misdemeanors. Because what I'm trying to stress is that if you require the police to explain why a child would not want to call, there's a lot of misdemeanors that could emerge out of the report. Would we want specifications about all those misdemeanors? And are we able to know all of them that will come out of the report? Can you respond to that?
Well,
Chair, we might not have covered, I just going to start with the issue raised by...
Are you having a something, Honourable Chair?
No, thank you, Professor. And let me apologize for arriving late. I had some commitments in the morning to attend to. But maybe on this aspect, complaints about injury or trauma of child detention. And please also, I just want to raise the issue that I've not been part of the process. So I might ask a question that was asked before. There is nothing said here relating to ICDs. Normally, these are referred to ICDs. It is only talking to the National Commissioner of Police and so on and so forth. But as far as I know, such issues are referred to the ICD for the ICD to investigate, but the independent complaints directorate. I'm not very sure as to why this one is being referred to the National Commissioner only. Maybe if just I can be clarified on this.
I'm just going to report to the issue of the details or what should go into the report. We might not have covered everything, but if you look at Regulation 3, the Station Commissioner is required to record to investigate the matter after being informed of the complaint. He's required to investigate the matter and then record his or her findings. And C sets out what should go into that recording, like the details and the extent of the injury, the circumstances surrounding the child, the details regarding the medical treatment that was received by the child, and any actions taken by the station commissioner. I don't know if my colleagues would want to speak.
Thank you, Chinya. We started out asking that it's something that we can include if no action, so to speak, is taken, why not?
Just what I would have liked to be asked, if the child is not referred for medical attention, the reasons why, I would have liked to have seen that as a thing. So when they read this regulation, they've actually got to apply their mind to the fact that should I ensure this child is sent to a doctor? I'm proposing, which I think they're happy with, that under this thing of this long list of what must be entered into the register, there's a further category. If the child is not referred to medical attention, medical treatment, the reasons why. So that the official, police officials have to actually apply their minds to the fact, do I take this child to the doctor or don't I?
Where are these details?
If you look on page 15.
What's this?
Regulations.
Oh, this?
No.
Page 15. Right.
Regulation 21, and then there's D, and then there's 1 to 11.
Okay.
There's a new one gets stuck in, so it'll be 1 to 12, saying if the police official, if the child is not taken to the for medical attention, medical treatment, the reasons why.
Where is that? Which number is that?
So I'm saying it's 21D, then you've got this list from 1 to 10, to 11, in Roman numerals. And I'm suggesting that an additional one gets put in maybe around, where's the medical report, there's 8 of the particulars of medical treatment which the child received, if any, maybe after that, if the child did not receive any medical treatment, or if the child was not sent to a doctor for examination, the reason.
I think it enhances the whole thing, but the question I was telling maybe for Mr. Malala was that certain game be on par with his content. What I was trying to say is that if a report is required with regard to this process, a number of times it will expose a number of misdemeanors. You would have to act on those misdemeanors, depending on the nature they were to cause the claim. Amongst other things, the failure to take the child to what to cause. My point is, would you want to
unless you rate that misdemeanor higher than any other misdemeanor that will emerge from the report.
But I was simply saying, if there's a report
there's a need to be a report about the complaint of injury or trauma of child in detention. In giving that report, you could find that there are a lot of other misdemeanors that emerge out of the report. You would require reasons why certain actions are not taken around those. So the point I was trying to say that as long as that is not exhaustive, it requires explanation to any other misdemeanor that emerges out of the report. But that point that you're making, I think we all agree. Yes.
I'd like to agree with Mr. Kunga on that. I mentioned right at the beginning that we saw the police, SAPS, asked for a meeting yesterday, and that's one of the issues that they raised with us, and they said it would be very difficult for a police official to deal with that, and they suggest that it come out. A number four, the impact of the injury or trauma on the child. They're not in a position to deal with that.
No, I agree with that. So are we through with chapter 4? Can we go to chapter 5?
Okay, just before I go to chapter 5, can I just perhaps clarify that in terms of the concern about where does the report end, is that the Act does provide that the Station Commissioner must submit the report to the National Commissioner. And I guess if there are issues of misconduct, it can be taken up at that level. And also that the complaint with regard to Section 28, I think it's the complaint that must be reported while the child is in detention. And I think the process can run parallel with reporting to the ICD. The child can report that after the release or after release from detention or after the offense has been finalized.
I'm not sure. I want to be very careful on this point. I was not saying it must be a prescribed requirement that when this report is given, it must also go, and the ICD must also interact with that. This is what I understand Olabushi Kunga to be emphasizing. Am I correct? This should not be something that happened by accident, if I understand that.
Yeah, I mean, it's Station Commissioner Mart. After having investigated, submit the report to the National Commissioner, ensure the National Commissioner has received the report, and file a copy. I think what we're saying, if I understand it right, would be an additional thing, ensure that the ICD receive a copy too.
Okay.
What the ICD do with it is up to them, but this is not being swept under the table.
Yes. In other words, you're taking away discretion on this matter.
Yeah. And Chair, sorry, before you go to the next chapter, the issue of the appropriate adult, I do think, I mean, it's actually here legally, but I do think that it's going to cause problems where the police are not going to read the Act. And so we're... Sorry?
They don't read the Act.
You'll fire all the people. So that maybe it should be more expressive around reminding them of the definition of appropriate adults in some way.
Can I just ask you, in the meeting that we had yesterday with the staff, they provided us informally with a draft, second draft, of the national instructions. And our understanding was exactly that the point raised by the member now will be covered in the instructions, and that is the reason for us now looking at that. And I'm just wondering if whether that will suffice, if that will, you know, it's no problem having it here, but I know there's a lot of issues that they're going to have to explain in the national instructions, which follow also on the regulations.
Why don't we then await those instructions and check to what extent we are addressing that concern?
Yeah, we can, because the difference is that the national instructions we get to see, but we don't approve.
Come back on that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's not submitted before the minute, and it's not like 30 days
for outside inspection. At the rate we're going, I mean, I don't know how much this should cost.
Isn't that honourable? We can make recommendations even if we don't have a right of approval.
We can, yes, but anyway, let's see what's there. But I mean, it's, you know, the 30 days, we're running out of time.
Yeah.
Okay, chapter 5 of the regulation deals with the assessment of a child. This chapter covers section 34 and 40 of the Act. In terms of section 39 of the Act, it requires the probation officer to inform a child of his or her rights in the prescribed manner. This is during the assessment of a child. Regulation 26 then speaks into this. It sets out how a probation officer should go about informing the child of his or her rights. And the emphasis again is here on the language used, to use plain language, to take into account the age and the maturity of the child, and to give sufficient information to the child, verifying in the process the child's understanding of the information given. And Section 40 of the Act requires the probation officer to complete an assessment report after assessing the child, and this must be done in a prescribed manner. This is done in Regulation 27. It sets out the manner in which the probation officer should complete the assessment form. For example, the probation officer is required to explain what information did he or she receive from the child, what information did he consider, and how did he arrive or she arrived at the outcome in, of the assessment. That is Chapter 5.
Thank you. Any issue on Chapter 5? Chapter 6?
Chapter 6 deals with the preliminary inquiry. In terms of Section 87 of the Act, it is required of the inquiry magistrate to, at the beginning of the inquiry, to inform the child and to explain to the child in a prescribed manner certain issues, such as the purpose of the inquiry, the allegations are leveled against the child, and the child's rights. And Regulation 28 deals with this matter. It sets out in a manner that will promote the child's understanding, and again the emphasis is also on the language that is used by the presiding officer when explaining or informing the child, taking into account the age and the maturity of the child, giving sufficient information, verifying the understanding of the child, and that is Chapter 6.
Yes,
Chapter 7.
Chapter 7 is the longest one. It deals with the issue of diversion. This chapter covers section from section 61 to section 61 to 62 of the Act. Section 53 of the Act contains a list of diversion options. And diversion options that are contained in that section are defined and a definition of some diversion orders, such as the compulsory school attendance, a family time order, a good behavior order, among the others. The section requires these orders to be issued in a prescribed manner. So Regulation 29 sets out the manner in which the orders should be issued, and we have prescribed a form to be used when issuing one of these orders. And this is Form 6, and it consists of different parts, and it appears that presiding officer may issue more than one diversion order. Section 56 of the Act provides that the cabinet member responsible for social development, in consultation with the relevant ministers, must establish and maintain a system of accreditation as prescribed of programs of diversion and diversion services provider, and ensure the availability of resources to implement diversion programs. Regulation 30 contains provisions to ensure that the resources are available to implement diversion programs. And we tried to prescribe Regulation 30 in accordance with the provisions of the Public Finance Management Act and its regulations. We have not described any regulation in terms of the establishing of a system of accreditation and the maintaining of this. This is because we felt that Section 56.2b of the Act speaks into this. It lists
at least what should be contained in the system, which must be established by the Minister of Social Development. For instance, the contents and the criteria that should be used, it's already in the Act. So that's the reason why we felt that there is no need to regulate that issue further. We also raised this issue when we sent out the first draft of the regulation for the public and all the role players to indicate whether our understanding of this is right and whether we should prescribe further in terms of the system of accreditation. And the commentators did not give us any suggestions. Regulation Section 5.2c of the Act provides that the Minister of Social Development must issue a prescribed certificate of accreditation to each diversion program and to each diversion service providers. And this is covered in Regulation 31. We have just designed a form for accreditation of a diversion service program and an accreditation certificate for accreditation of a diversion service provider. And then Section 66.2g of the Act deals with quality assurance, and it provides that the quality assurance process must be conducted in the prescribed manner. Then Regulation 32 speaks to this. This regulation requires that the quality assurance process must be done by a panel, and the regulation regulates the composition, how should that panel be combined. It also regulates the process to be followed in doing the actual quality assurance process and the preparation of the report and the submission of the report. The panel must submit the report to the minister. And we try to align this to some extent with the provision that is in the Children's Act regulation. Section 67 and 68 of the Act deals with the compliance with a diversion order. This section provides that where a diversion order is made, the presiding officer must identify a probation officer or any other suitable person to monitor whether the child does comply with the diversion order. And then should the child fail to comply with the diversion order, the probation officer or this other person identified must, in a prescribed manner, notify the presiding officer in writing of the child's failure. And Section 58 of the Act provides that in the case of non-compliance, the presiding officer, after being notified in the prescribed manner, may order the issue of the warrant of arrest or cause the summons to be issued against the child. Then Regulation 33 deals with non-compliance by the child. In the case of non-compliance, the magistrate or the inquiry magistrate or the child court must be notified by way of a form which must be prescribed in the regulation. The probation officer must, when a child has successfully complied with the diversion order, submit a prescribed report to the relevant prosecutor, who in turn must submit a copy of that report to the clerk of the court in question. This is covered in Regulation 34, the report. Covered in the regulation 34. Then Section 61 of the Act requires the Director General for Social Development to establish and maintain a register as prescribed of children in respect of whom a diversion order has been made. Section 63 provides that access to the register must be limited as prescribed to certain persons. And Regulation 35 and 36 regulate the content of the register, the content and access to the register. In terms of Regulation 35, the Director General must designate an official in his or her department to be responsible for the register, who will make entries to the register and maintain the register. The regulation also sets out the procedure, how to deal with the diversion orders that are received. And Regulation 36, a person who wishes to access the register must complete a form and identify themselves, and then submit the form to the person designated by the Director General or to the Director General, him or herself, and then the Director General will make the decision whether to grant or not to grant access to the register.
That is chapter 7, I'm sure.
Maybe now is the time you deal with diversion, like the compliance in 58 and 79. Maybe that's the time you go to Olabija. That's it. And then Olabija.
Thank you. Yeah, it just regards the suitable person or the probation officer. Now, suitable person worries me because how are we going to define who a suitable person is? Who I think is suitable might not be who Honourable Jeffrey thinks is suitable. And I think that, you know, it's an important thing to see whether this child is compliant or not. Now, for example, you could say that a suitable person is the parent. Well, obviously the parent wouldn't want to see the child getting into any more trouble and would therefore say that they're compliant. And this worries me. I think we should take suitable person out and just keep it as officer.
Take note of that.
Well, I mean, I've kind of brought the attention. I mean, suitable person is defined in the Act. And it's basically a person identified by the probation officer. So that's who defines it. But, I mean, unless we amend the Act, we're stuck with suitable person. But when you get to these, family time order, I see in each of these orders is a person identified to report back, which is right. But my worry is, or maybe just somebody asking if they can just answer right away, is the regulations relating to 57.2, where are they? That is if they fail to comply with the diversion order. Okay, that's 33. You see, my worry is this issue of the reporting back and the failure to comply, and particularly when you've got a maybe a teacher for the school, compulsory school attendance. Or a parent, you say when the diversion order is issued that X is the whatever the wording is, and you must report back. But what is reporting back? You then have a regulation to say when the probation officer or the person identified must fill up this form 9. But I just how often do they do this? Do they do it at the end? That's too late. If the kid is not attending the school, or there's actually problems at home, they've got a family whatever the order is, you want to get it immediately so that it can be corrected. So I'm just worried about this whole concept of reporting back. Reporting back seems to be at the end. That may be too late for the child to correct them. And maybe there should be, and I don't know if you've had whether anyone made submissions on it, maybe there should be, how long are these diversion orders again? Maybe you should, because you're going for belts and braces, sorry? 12 to 48 months, yeah. Okay, so that really, I think, proves my point. You don't want at the end of the 48 months a report to come along to say, well, the child was given a compulsory school attendance order or family time order, and the mother comes and says, no, actually, I didn't. They did it for a month, and then they refused to listen to me. So maybe there should be provision for reporting back to the, for better monitoring. I think it would be to the probation officer. So maybe a requirement on the probation officer. Maybe this Form 9 should not be filled up at the end. You're not going to have many, but just look at it again. I'm just trying to think. You're likely to have one kid in one school with one teacher assigned to them.
Yeah.
Okay. So you say to that teacher, okay, you fill it up every month. The probation officer must then monitor, get that Form 9 every month from the teacher, whether the school, compulsory school attendance is being met with. And then some kind of reporting mechanism, because otherwise kids are kids. They're going to fall through the system when they could have been corrected. A sort of
And you don't have to take action, correct the thing, but there's the opportunity. But I can just see what's going to happen. These kids get diversion orders. They stop complying halfway through. At the end, there's a report form 9 submitted that they didn't comply, and then they're in deeper trouble, whereas if there's been an early warning, yeah. So just can you look at that again, please?
Yeah. I don't get that, because I think what is trying to avoid is what we call this malicious compliance. That a child has been diverted to that program, and then you check at the end of the prescribed period, and you find the program has never served what you call the purpose. The question is, how do you pick it up timelessly so that you avoid damages? Okay?
Yeah, I can just add, we will look at that, but I think we just have to bear in mind also, if you look at Section 58, in any case where there is a failure to comply with a diversion order, then that failure must be brought to the attention, if I read the Act correctly, to the magistrate, and the magistrate will then have to either issue a summons or even arrest the child to bring him. But I have no problem in saying that we must strengthen it also to facilitate that, the earlier process.
Yeah. And it's summons extend incorporation of status point. You know, it's a family time order, okay? The parents, you've got to make it the parents. The kid then doesn't abide by it. The parent is not going to want the kid to be arrested, so they're not going to go for 48. And whereas if you've got a requirement that the parent must fill up the form every month, the probation officer checks with just better monitoring, because you are going to have people, or you have a teacher who's not particularly interested in the child, who will compel you to attend. And so on. And there's also probably more pressure on the child if you have a monthly report. You know, so your mother, your father is filling up this report every month. If they don't fill it up at the end, the end is in 12 months. You get my question.
You've made your point, Christian.
All the important things. You can put down
good.
The here.
Just a technical question around Section 58. Just the wording. And I think it's been covered in terms of Regulation 33, but if you look at the industry's flight manner, it could refer to the notification, but it also could refer to the action of the inquiry magistrate or child justice court with regard to the issuing of the warrant for arrest. So I think I'm covered. I think it does refer to the notification, but I just wanted you to confirm that. Thanks.
So we also
struggle
with the information.
Alright, I guess we'll go with chapter 7. Chapter 8,
Chapter 8,
I hope your daughter can still tell you.
Chapter 8 of the regulation deals with the trial in the child justice court. In the child justice court and covers section 63 to 67 of the Act. If we look at section 63.3 of the Act, it provides that before a plea is taken in the child justice court, the presiding officer must, in a prescribed manner, inform and explain to the child the nature of the allegation, his or her rights, and the procedure to be followed in terms of the Act. And then the regulation 37 speaks to this. It sets out how the presiding officer should inform and explain to the child. The regulation, among other things, provides for the use of simple and plain language, taking into account the age and maturity and the stage of development of the child. And then Section 65 of the Act, which is to some extent linked or must be read with Section 1 of the Act, the definition of an independent observer, requires every district court magistrate to keep a list of independent observers who may be appointed to assist the child where the child is not assisted in court by a parent, appropriate adult, or guardian. Then Section 38, up until Section 40 of the regulation, I beg your pardon, Regulation 38 up until Regulation 40
regulate the process of drawing up the list that we are talking about and the information to be contained in that list and factors to be taken into account by the magistrate when appointing an independent observer. Regulation 28 requires that the nomination must be obtained from the community, nominations for an independent observer, and we have designed Form 11 for that purpose, which form must be completed by the person who is nominating, indicating, and then the person who is nominated must indicate whether he or she accepts the nomination. From the nominations, a list will be the first magistrate will compile a list containing the information indicated in Regulation 49, Section 9, which information includes the person's language, proficiency, his or her occupation, social interests, and cultural background. This information, we think that it will assist the presiding officer in making an informed decision when appointing an independent observer. Regulation 40 deals specifically with the appointment by the court, and it places an obligation on the presiding officer to ensure that the person is suitable to assist the child, the person appointed as an independent observer is suitable to assist the child, and that the child also accepts that person appointed, and the person is willing to assist that particular child. That's chapter 8.
Yeah. I mean, I've got a problem with 38.1. Magistrates must, for the purposes of compiling a list of independent observers, invite religious groups, community structures, and NGOs within the district to nominate persons to serve as independent observers. If you look at the definition of independent observer, it's a representative from a community or organization or a CDS. Okay? And I don't think the two sort of talk together. I would have thought that the magistrates must advertise. Because I think we even intended that there is a requirement they can't be in full-time employer of the state. But you could be, you've got a community structure and an NGO. You could have a ward committee member. You could have a donor or somebody from a traditional council. It's not covered. The two don't talk to each other. I think it should rather read 38.1 should invite representatives from a community. From a community or from organizations or from the CPS should be done publicly in the newspaper or on the radio. But you are narrowing it to religious groups, community structures, and NGOs. What is a CPS? That's not a radio, it's not an NGO. Is it a community structure? It's a statutory body. I don't know. I'm confused about a CPS, but the Act specifically provides for a CPS. What about a person of standing in the community? They've got to be nominated by an organisation. Why can't they be nominated by the councillor? Why can't they apply themselves? It doesn't. They can't. People can't nominate themselves the way you've done it. Whereas in terms of the Act. Whereas in terms of the Act. Somebody can nominate themselves. I don't have a problem with that. The magistrate is appointing them. So I do think that 38.1 is not consistent with the definition of independent observer, and it needs to be changed. Narrower, in fact.
38.1.
Yeah.
Well, here it is that the people must invite religious groups, the group, community structures and NGOs within the district to nominate. Sorry? Yeah, but it invites the organizations to nominate. So basically, 381, you can't get to be an independent observer unless you get an organization to nominate you. And that's not what is implied in the Act. I think it needs to be allow for people to nominate themselves. And then, you know, you get some, I would have thought if we're going to subscribe it, then it should be to must ensure that advertisements put in the court, because here it's, you know, must invite religious groups. So the magistrate could decide, okay, I'm going to just write to the churches and nobody knows about it. And then the Act specifically provides for CPFs, whereas CPFs are not mentioned in India.
How is this
in India? The Act reads it is independent observer for the purposes of 65.6 means a representative from a community. Okay, so rep of the community, or organization, or CPS, who's not in the full-time employ of the state, and whose name appears on a subscribed list.
Does the regulation necessarily contradict that?
Yes, because the regulation requires you get nominated by a structure, whereas I don't think the thing prevents individuals from applying.
You know why I'm raising this point, just probably it's correct to improve it. But if the Act is open, beyond what is prescribed here, does that stop magistrate to exploit the openness of the Act?
Because the magistrate will agree the regulation. That's what the police will do too.
Okay.
Thank you. We can't the concern. I think when we the idea behind the so to speak nomination was there's also no provision in the Act that you can really apply criteria. And although we know this independent observer will only take the place of a parent, so it's not as if this person will have enormous power, but yet some concerns when we have the one-on-one were raised is, but what about, and I'm not saying it either, it's a likelihood that will happen, a gangster coming to the fore and say, listen, here's my nomination, the magistrate may not, the presiding officer may not know this person. So we try through this also to get some kind of respected person and not only a person coming to the fore, that you have that kind of safety mechanism through nomination. And also that's why, to some extent, we did provide for the issues pertaining to, you know, what are you doing, where you come from, etc. But that was the background, whether we
were
right or wrong is another story.
You know what I'm worried about? Let me not use the word, it could sound very serious. When I asked you about the forensic psychologist, you referred me to when it deals with criminal capacity. It narrowed the role of a forensic psychologist in the modern administration of justice, in the sense that forensic psychologists are not just dealing with the issue of criminological capacity, but assist the justice system to improve effective administration of justice in general by making sure that there's a clearer picture of the object of the person who is being appearing before the court. But when you talk independent observers, this concept, I'm not sure if it's a concept that does not find place in a more broader way in our legal system. I'm interested in your comments, yeah?
No, it's a little comment. I want to come back to you.
Yes.
The new commandment. I'm just curious.
I thought it's a modern popular intervention to improve the administration of justice in Tanzania. Mm-hmm.
I think on the issue, on the concept of the independent observer and the forensic psychologist, I think those are two different, yes, they may be used if they are nominated, the forensic, if they are nominated.
Okay.
Yes, and I think also they can apply in terms of, because the Act provides for a pre-sentence report. Before a child is sentenced, the court may call for a pre-sentence report.
Mm-hmm.
They may also apply, play a role in that regard.
Maybe the Act could have been better
mm-hmm.
phrased, but it's basically if where a child is not assisted by a parent or appropriate adult, so that's a sort of family member, or a guardian, and the child requests assistance, an independent observer may, in exceptional circumstances, be appointed by the presiding officer. Okay. Then the independent observer is a person whose name appears on a prescribed list. So the list is prescribed. Now the way they've done it is that anyone can nominate, and if the person accepts the nomination, the magistrate must, if the nominee has been accepted, and if the thing has been completed to the satisfaction of the magistrate, in other words, you filled up all the spaces, you must enroll the name. Now, I don't think that's right. I think that on the prescribed list, that there would be space to give the magistrate of the district the power to decide whose name is on that list. So I do think that it's possible to invite the community for nominations, to open for nominations, you can nominate yourself. But then the magistrate looks at the nomination and then decides this person is appropriate or not appropriate. So I don't think paedophile X comes along and wants to be a independent observer and goes and nominates himself. And because he fills up all the blank spaces on the form, he's then asked to be put on the list. No. I do think this needs to be re-looked at, these regulations, and I think that the Act would allow for the magistrate to prescribe that the magistrate decides who's on the list.
All right.
Can I just think of, if this consider the issue of whether or not to reject
I would have thought that again the regulations could assist the magistrates. I mean, they definitely, if they reject, they'd have to give reasons. But the regulations could assist with no special skills to assist the child, no understanding of the processes that the child would need to embark upon. Inappropriate behavior, there would be like maybe three or four categories that would be quite easy. Not formal qualification.
Where's the qualification?
Yeah, I think the requirement is in the magistrate's opinion, the person must have standing in the community, and if the person, if the magistrate feels the person doesn't have standing, then that's a basis for rejecting.
You got your attendance.
Chapter
chapter 9 of the regulation deals with sentencing. The chapter covers section 68 up to 79 of the Act. If you look at section 72, 73, and 74, it provides that a child justice court can sentence a child to a community-based sentence, a restorative justice sentence, or a fine or alternative to fine. Then the court must request the probation officer to monitor the child's compliance with that sentence and report back in a prescribed manner. Then Regulation 41, 42, and 43 speak to that. It sets out the manner in which the probation officer should report back to court, the content of the report to be compiled by the probation officer, and the procedure for submitting the report to the presiding officer. Regulation 41, amongst other things, requires that the report must, in the case of a sentence, or a community-based sentence, indicate the progress made in complying with the order, with specific reference to the objectives of the sentencing, the views of the child regarding his or her progress, and the motivation for any recommendation. And Regulation 42 provides, among other things, in respect of a restorative justice sentence, must indicate whether there were any impediments in complying with the sentence, and on how these impediments were overcome, and the settings of behavior of the child in carrying out the sentence. Regulation 43 provides that the progress report must include the amount that the sentence of a fine or alternative to a fine, so that the progress report must include an amount of the compensation paid to the person in question and the views of the child relating to his or her sentence and the responsibility. This is among other matters. And in terms of, if we look at section 76 of the Act, which provides for a sentence of compulsory residence in a child and youth care center, the sentence may not exceed 5 years or go beyond the date on which the child turns 21, which means that when you sentence a child can be in a child and youth care center up until the age of 21. However, a child sentence for a Schedule 3 offenses, as we indicated that Schedule 3 offenses are the most serious offenses, may be sentenced to more than 5 years. And if there are substantial and compelling reasons, the child may be required to spend the rest of the sentence in prison. On the child's completion of the sentence, the head of a child and youth care center must submit a prescribed report to court containing his or her views whether the objectives of the sentencing have been complied with, have been achieved, and the possibility of the reintegration of a child into the society without facing the additional term of imprisonment. The Act also requires that the order must be brought to the attention of the relevant child and youth care center in the prescribed manner. This section further requires that a child who has been sentenced must be taken to in a prescribed manner to the center in question. So Regulation 44 requires regulates the contents of this report and the procedure to submit the report to the child and youth care center, and we have designed a form which is complex. The report must indicated which of the objectives of section 69 have been complied with. That is the report which is compiled by the head of the child and youth care center. And also state the possible reasons thereof. The report must also reflect the patterns of behavior of the child while the child was at the child and youth care center, the negative or positive incident in which the child was involved, the child's ability to adjust to his or her new environment and his or her relationship with the other persons at the center or the staff. And then Regulation 45 sets out the procedure to be followed when taking a child to a child and youth care center. This includes the proper control of a child, when the site is transported to the site and new care center by means of least evasive measures and in a manner that takes into account the safety of the child and the safety of the members of the community. And the child must be transported in such a way that as not to infringe with the dignity of the child. And the Regulation 46 deals with the manner of bringing the court order into the attention of the child and the center to which the child is sentenced. Provision is made in this regulation that the date on which the child was will complete the sentence at the center must be recorded by the clerk of the court, by the court and the clerk of the court. And then the clerk of the court must advise the head of the child and the youth care center to submit a report that is referred to in Regulation 44 within 6 weeks, that is before the date of the completion of the sentence. And this will enable the presiding officer to summarily make a decision as to whether the child should be released or the child should serve the rest of the sentence of imprisonment. And in terms of when you look at the Section 79 of the Act, if the child fails to comply with the community-based sentence, a restorative justice sentence, or fails to pay a fine, the probation officer must report back to court the failure to the presiding officer. And the child must, in the prescribed manner, be brought before court for an inquiry. The Regulation 47 speaks to this. It sets out the procedure of reporting to the court and bringing the child to court. This regulation covers more of basic and administrative procedures in terms of bringing the child back to court. This is chapter
9.
Yeah, it's basically a similar problem to the diversion one. That this is now 72 and 73, the community-based, and there's a requirement that of progress reports. But basically, if you look at Regulation 41, the progress reports are compiled when it was immediately on after the date on which the conditions of sentence have been complied with, so it's not a progress report, it's a completion report. And then alternatively, whenever the probation officer deems it necessary. Now, I would have thought that with these, and the same would be with a restorative justice sentence. You know, it's a progress report, but it must indicate it largely comes at the end. I think that there should be more detail in the regulation requiring the magistrate to order a progress report on a regular basis. I mean, I don't know if you want to go to every month, but because if you leave it up to the probation officer, maybe they're busy and they don't get around to giving regular reports.
Yeah.
I just have a question. Once the child has completed the sentences, a report goes through. I know they make provision for any other information, but to what extent would there be space for something about where the child would go, what would happen to the child once they completed their sentence, and what kind of support structures are in place for that child? I'm just talking, the whole purpose is to have children who function well, and when, once they're released, I mean, that we stop our responsibility you know, at a certain point, and then we just let them out into the community. And so I'm not too sure whether regulations are the place to do it, but
it's a tough one. I'll tell you, there are issues that, in my view, this law will never be able to do. We just have to improve the state of the entire society. It's like in education, there are things that can never be taught by teachers. You just have to sort out the society. Because really, an ideal purpose for any law is to complement society. Now, if it just replaces society, it just doesn't work. But I think your point is very important, because it begins to say, are we confident that this formal system at its particular end, is it adequate for the further development of the town? And I think that's the question I raise. But my point is that I think law on its own would be found wanting. There are bigger challenges that the whole society must attend. But you want to respond?
Yes, I think that what would happen is that when the court is being asked to use the restorative justice option as a sentence, that restorative justice option, by the definition of restorative justice, means that this child needs to be reintegrated into society, reintegrated into the community from which this child comes. So if there's if the child has been sentenced to a secure care facility, you know, it's a custodial sentence, then before that child is released, there's a program within the secure care facility, as there is within a prison facility, of reintegration services to reintegrate that child. If there's a diversion option to which the child has been sentenced, then that option too, and I know that right now NICRO is the family service provider, incorporates reintegration into those programs.
Yeah. I think it's one of the, amongst million required solutions, is one of them. Yeah. You want to go to the test? Oh, I thought you were engaging in it.
Proceed. And Dr. Tenby was like a question, and it's a short one. It says the legal representation, and for this purpose, regulation 48, please with it. Section 83 of the Act provides that where a child appears in a child justice court and the client or does not want to have a legal representation, the representative, the court may instruct the legal aid board to appoint a legal representative to assist the court in a prescribed manner. So regulation 48 sets out the manner in which such a legal representative who is not appointed by the judge but appointed by the court may assist the court. And the regulation 48 covers the basic issues, basic powers and duties that a legal representative must be given to be able to assist the court, such as being able to have access to the document and to the statement, or being able to address the court.
The legal representative must attend all the hearings of the case. Does that mean they must attend the preliminary inquiry? Is that a hearing of the case?
Yes.
Now, why are we saying that when we didn't really want them there? We said nothing shall preclude them attending.
Yes.
Now we're saying the regulations, they must attend.
But that's if the child chooses to have a legal representation.
No, but 83 is where they don't want them. You know, so then you give them more representation than normal. Yeah, but normal than other children.
What is your point there?
I think there's a contradiction here.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, okay, where the section 83 is where the child doesn't wish to have a legal representative,
yeah,
or refuses to give instructions,
mm-hmm,
then the court must appoint a legal representative. Okay? So this is basically a case where the child says, no, I don't want a lawyer, but because they have a child, we're saying, no, you have to have one. So it's an odd circumstance. Now, in that case, they must attend all the hearings of the case, according to this. Now, my concern with the preliminary inquiry, we haven't been, you know, the Act says that a lawyer can attend, they can't be precluded from attending the preliminary inquiry. The other might be remand. I mean, I think a remand is a hearing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you're saying to this legal representative, you must go and wait for hours for just a remand. So I don't know if that's I think really what I'm saying is, I think it's helpful having setting out what they must do, because it's an odd situation. But I don't think you need to say they must attend all the hearings of the case. Or when the matter is, when evidence is led, or something like that. You know, that you limit it.
So you don't think they must attend all the...
My problem is with Regulation 48.1a, the legal representative must attend all the hearings of the case. A hearing could be a remand, as far as I'm concerned. I think what is meant is that when evidence is led, they should be there. You know, maybe you should put be present during, because attend the hearing of the case, so you rock up, you're there, and then you say, okay, bye, I'm going, and then you're not there. So if you're going for the belt and braces, it would be present throughout the meeting of evidence in the case.
If I may just respond, I think one of the reasons why the requirement of attend all hearings was there was because what we found in practice is that, especially where the clients are children, legal representatives don't pitch and it causes delays in the cases. So we're trying to compel them to be there and to ensure that if there is a delay, you've got to answer to the magistrate why you're requiring, if you're requiring the postponement, you know, why that is so.
But can I kind of raise the difficulty I have there is, this is a specific case of legal representatives. Legal representatives where the child does not want to be represented. I agree with you, you know, but then you're saying where the child does have a legal representative, they do say to the court, the magistrate, I want one, and the court appoints somebody from the legal aid board. They don't have to be there for every hearing, like the ones who the child doesn't want. You see the contradiction. In the Act, for your general legal representative requirement, there's a requirement that legal representatives must ensure that everything is concluded without delay and deals, and legal representatives must deal with the matter in a manner to ensure the best interest of the child at all time of paramount importance. But the way it's phrased is that it's often better for the child, maybe, to say, I don't want a lawyer, and then they get better treatment. They'll be self-doubt.
Chair, I hear what JJ is saying, and I agree with him to a very large extent. But I think if one thinks of why a child would reject legal assistance, why a child would say they wouldn't want an attorney, I think that would be a child with a serious problem. Because no child in a normal sort of, well, and no child in a normal situation would need an attorney. But especially in this case, why would a child reject legal representation? There's something seriously wrong in a situation where a child, and I mean even the parents, would reject legal representation. So I understand why this specific section is compelling the legal representative to be there. I do understand, but I do also hear what JJ is saying, is that it does create this anomaly between the two cases. But in practice, and unfortunately I've seen this too often, it creates an anomaly between the children that request legal assistance and the children that reject legal assistance.
How does it create an anomaly?
Well, what it's doing, and that's what JJ just explained, the kids that request legal assistance, their attorneys are not required by law to be at all hearings. But the children that reject legal assistance, the law actually stipulates, this regulation stipulates that they must attend all hearings. But now what worries me is if we start defining what all hearings are, what if the attorney doesn't pitch up for the pretrial? Now, in my opinion, the pretrial is probably more important than anything else, because that determines where the case goes. If the attorney is just there in the leading of evidence, they're going to miss out on serious parts of the case. So, I understand, and JJ is making perfect sense. Legal representatives cannot sit in court all day. We're going to have to find a mechanism where we make sure that these legal representatives are there for when the child needs it. Because, quite frankly, a 10-year-old child, a 14-year-old child, a 16-year-old child, they don't understand what's going on in a courtroom. And it's terrifying. As an adult, you know what it's like if you get summoned to court. It's not a pleasant experience at all. And we can't take the chance that we leave something out and these kids land up in court on their own.
I think we need to bridge it in the sense that an interest of the child, that principle of the interest of the child is an objective principle, not a subjective or to call. It balances both the subjective and the objective principle. Now, my understanding is that if there's this suggestion that he should be there in the interest of the child, it's irrespective of what the child thinks, because the court wants to be assisted to act in the interest of the court, of the child. So in that instance, I think the disjunction or contradiction is the attitude of the children, but not the principle itself. This is the point, I think, this is where I understand them not to be irreconcilable. Because the interest of the child remains the interest of the child, whether the child is in agreement or not. Yes. So the point I'm making is that that principle always has to be served. Of course, in a situation where the child doesn't want a legal representative, you will have to manage a different way of serving that very interest, even there. Do you want to comment on this?
I think just to take the point of the member further, if a child is rejecting legal representation, you almost know immediately that child is rejecting being part of the system and is almost displaying antisocial behavior. That child's rights are probably at greater risk if there is no legal representation at every hearing. And that's why it was written into the Act that child particularly should have his or her rights protected, and requiring legal representation there.
I think we find one of this.
No.
No, we may not find you, just as we do find you. I think it should be relooked at.
I think maybe that there is a requirement that in the cases of where the child doesn't want the legal representative, that it has to be prescribed, which is what they've done. But I think that the path for the minister to make incidental matters, and maybe there should be a section also generally on requirements of legal representatives. Because, you know, attend all hearings.
Hello?
Attend all hearings of the case. What does that mean? You've got to sit there throughout? I don't think it does. I think you can attend and then you can pop out and go and do some other remands in another court. That's not what was envisaged. But you've gone so belt and braces on this that you've allowed for that opening. Must address when requested by the court. Have all access to the dockets, ensure the best interests of the child. You see, the difficulty is, I mean, your legal representative can go along the way you've got it here if you're wanting to specify what they must do. They can go along and they can do other work. They cannot even focus on the case except there's the best interest of the child requirement. So I'm not sure why they've got this belt and braces thing. I think that the legal representative must ensure that the best interests of the child are upheld. I would have thought that is sufficient. We can talk about it more afterwards.
The advance of belt and braces approach, which is easy to cut through if you're a lazy legal representative.
Yes?
I just wanted to just say this. If you go to prison, many of youth, young children as well, or children, will not want legal aid board lawyers. they think they are state lawyers, and therefore they would want to send them to prison. Because they will, this will be very common. And if we put a mask on any rejection, then I think I accredit it. Many of them, if you go to prison today, if you say legal aid board lawyer, they don't want them. They say they are state lawyers, they will send them to prison. That is very common. So it won't be something that happens once because of maybe the community or the society influence and so on. It's something that they believe in, and you have to deal with it first before. But if you now have a mask, I'm just saying that.
I think it's not a mask to the child. It's a mask to the effective administration of justice. And how you manage it becomes a different question, because I think the concern of CHEP maybe is in the management of that. I don't think CHEP rejects the importance of ensuring that the court is assisted to ensure the best interest of the child. Now the question maybe he is asking is that, is there no different way you can put it?
Chair, you just covered my point, because I was going to say the operative word here is assist the court.
Yeah.
Not necessarily, well, the, in the process will be assisting the child as well. Yeah.
You
help
the court to administer justice effectively. Okay. Maybe what you need to look is that detail of all the time. If Jeff is worried about, but without compromising the importance of assisting the court in the best interest of the
child. I would have thought that it would have, I mean, just firstly for Honourable Chikunga, the Act, it's in the Act of the Regulations that the child must have a lawyer, can't refuse. We were just joking about why they think the legal aid lawyers are that they go to jail, was because they're often so bad that they always go to jail.
So can I hand over my colleague to take over the
Okay. Your pen?
Are you lifting your hand? Open the book as we come.
Chapter 12 actually is a miscellaneous provision in line with Chapter 14 of the Act. And here we will get a number of provisions dealing with different matters. The first is, which is the referral of information relating to the age of the child to the Department of Home Affairs. You will, may recall it was a situation where, for instance, the child doesn't have a birth certificate and they were worried about the age, and then there's an age determination, and then that age determination, so to speak, order will be submitted to the Department of Home Affairs for consideration of issuing a ID book, etc. So this is just now to report back to say, what have you done? Have you registered the age, yes or no? That is what that is. Regulation 653 is all about. It regulates the manner, and we can just say in the process of consultation, we did speak on a number of occasions to the Department of Home Affairs. They indicated to us what is the process in terms of their act that needs to be followed. It's not as if the mere receipt of that determination of age, they can just issue it. They have to get an application from the parents of the child, etc., but they will facilitate that, and eventually we got agreement on the regulations as regulation as it stands now. So and just we want them to report back quickly on what steps that they've taken, and if they haven't registered the age, why they haven't done so, etc. And then section 97(6) of the Act requires the DG Social Development to keep a register as prescribed of children who have been dealt with in terms of section 9. If I'm mistaken, those are the children that are under the age of 10 years and who have been diverted from the system. Regulations 454 and 55 regulate the procedure in terms of which a probation officer, after making a decision in terms of section 9, must submit the information to the DG so that the DG can compile the register. And it also regulates again by whom and how the register may be accessed. And we also, when dealing with the regulations, look at the regulation 22, which also deals with the register for children in detention. We tried also just to take care that of the different provisions of the Act to the extent that was applicable. And then the second last regulation is just a general regulation, a catch-all regulation to say if we haven't described any way in which or the way in which a particular notice must be submitted, then we say it must be submitted in this way. And this way means by hand registered both facsimile and electronically. The last regulation is the short title and commence.
Yes. Chapter 12, Ms. Elena. Yes. My understanding is one of the members is that wasn't necessarily interfacing with this presentation with the intention of taking this. You would want to give, in the context of agency that we are faced with, what is to. Can you talk this? Very intimidated. So partners, could they have a chance to just quickly on informed basis in the next meeting say, we think the regulations are fine. It was more of an information not to call session. I thought what is actually required now, having taken into account all the issues raised, when we come to a final situation, I think before we come to final adopt, you would have actually looked at all the proposals that have been made. So we adopt an updated one that takes into account the discussions that have taken place. But I think the next thing now is to go to an implementation, which is going to be a very short one. Honorable Jack?
Yeah, just...
I mean, my understanding is hopefully as a result of the inputs here, but I think also as a result of we've been told of inputs from other government sectors, the amendments are going to have to be withdrawn.
Which amendments?
The regulations are going to have to be withdrawn because they can't be amended. So it's clear that amendments are needed. And the procedure, formal procedure, would be minister would withdraw it, retable it, and then we have to formally adopt it. Can we have a look? Can we get copies as members of this committee of the redrafted regulations so we're able to make input before the minister approves them for reintroduction? So we don't have a problem of that the adoption effectively becomes a formality. That's sort of one. Yeah. Then two would be, I don't know, Chair, when you were wanting to cover it, but the NPA directives and the police instructions, when are we getting those? NPA directives have to be approved by us. Police directives don't get approved, but have to be tabled 30 days before implementation.
I think while you are entering, you need to apply all my law at the same time. At the beginning, the order of the law was already here. We found ourselves facing a situation where the process of putting this education school ready for implementation has been completed in terms of the process. That these regulations were supposed to be dealt with by December, that is not happened. A number of other things have not been done, and this has to be implemented by April.
One.
Now, I think what we are telling you now is to engage with the process in line with the defect, and knowing well that we are required now to ensure that by the 1st of April, the law is implemented. Can we, whatever contribution we are making now, should be what contingencies, whatever the right thing we should. What measures we put in place to align with the 1st of April, taking into account the background of the defect. So you can proceed.
Yeah, well, look, it was basically the, let's start with the NPA, we've dealt with the regulations, let's start with the NPA directives. When is the Minister of Justice going to table them? The NPA directives.
Okay.
I'm going to hand over to my colleagues that deal with that.
We chair the ISCCJ, and in our most recent meeting we asked for reports from everybody. The NPA have indicated that the directives are with the NDPP. They're waiting for approval from the NDPP. So that's where they are. They're on his table at the moment. And that's what we've been told.
Okay.
Chair, I would suggest that we maybe, as acting chair, that you speak to the minister about this, that we need them urgently. But then the other would then be the police ones. And I don't know how much of this would be our committee or the police committee, but they have to, the cabinet member responsible for safety and security must submit any national instructions provided for to Parliament 30 days before they are issued. And after the 30-day period, publish them in the Gazette. Now, the difficulty is going to be this Act comes into effect 1st of April. I don't know if you need police instructions to operate under the Act. Maybe you don't. Maybe you can use the Act without it, but I don't think it's desirable. And basically, then you can't have those instructions operating until 30 days have elapsed. So if those instructions are going to be operating when the Act comes into effect on the 1st of April, then they must be tabled by the 1st of March. Luckily, March is 31 days. So basically, also then for the chair of the police committee to be aware of that and to look at how that is followed up. And yeah.
Am I correct just to say, that the committee is not willing to budge on the 1st of April?
Yeah, we've got no choice. We have to amend the Act if we're going to do it.
Now, let me say, in principle, the committee would not want to. Let me tone it down. In principle, the committee would not want to budge with the implementation on the 1st of April. Now, the next question is, can our technical people come together and say what is possible under the circumstances
so as to ensure that by the 1st of April, this law is implemented. Because my fear is that the number of details that a meeting like this cannot be able to deal. But what we throw into the meeting is that we want the bill to be implemented by the 1st of April. Can our team, support team, the committee support team, who are dealing with content, with the department, by Friday, I don't think we need to wait, by Friday, be able to say to us, this is the process that can be embarked upon in order to be able to implement this by the 1st of April. Is it short-circuiting or is it a fair process?
Chair, I was just talking about the regulations because that's our responsibility. If we can get the parliamentary dates and times, we can, I've got no doubt that we will have the regulations. These changes that we're going to do are going to be done within the next day or two. So from the regulation point of view that we've just discussed, I'm pretty confident that we can...
Can you switch it off? We're dealing with the Department of Justice. To us, Department of Justice is everything. We don't want the Department of Justice to tell us it is not the police, it is not NPA, it is not anything. In this committee, it is the Department of Justice. So what we are saying is that you interact with all the relevant stakeholders so that you are able to propose on Friday a process that can help us to ensure that the law is implemented by the Department of Justice. I wouldn't want a situation where you sit here and say, we don't know what and TPP is going to do. I don't think you want to engage committee on that. Is that fine?
Yeah.
So you will liaise with Christine on that. Can we leave it at that, honourable members? Do we want to go to the details of the implementation plan under the circumstances? No. Until that process is finalized, the implementation plan will only make sense after that.
Is there a document on that?
No.
Yes.
On the implementation plan, yes.
What I'm saying, Honourable Chair, is that
this can only make sense while that process is clarified.
Except, Chair, my worry is just that
we've got a month to go, and I don't know if I can get a copy of that implementation plan, and then I think Mr. Chikunga as well, unless we've only got a month to go, a month and 2 weeks to go. So if there are things that are not being done, we're not going to know about it until too late.
Okay.
Too late.
No, what I'm saying is that by Friday they must be pressed out that one. I think they must be able to say to us it is possible to implement this deal by the 1st of April, subject to these things which we think are going to happen. Or they must say, we have looked at it from all angles. Under the circumstances, it is not possible. This is what is being proposed. Yes.
Chair, may I just suggest that we're quite happy to do the initial presentation now as the Department of Justice. We chair the intersectoral committee and we'll be able to give responses. But if we're going to do a proper presentation to the committee on the implementation plan of the Child Justice Bill, that the other relevant departments be invited to respond to queries that might arise in respect of specific aspects of implementation that are their responsibility.
Is it possible then, members, to find a special day next week, only to deal with this process issue?
Mm-hmm.
And we hope Honorable Chikunga will also be here, and the chair of the, which other committee? And the respective departments concerned, Christian?
We need correctional services, social development, education.
Can I say you will give those details, but can I impress upon all the relevant people that when we meet next week, demonstrate to us you have interacted with the stakeholders, they are ready to address us with regard to our concerns. They will not be interacting with us for the first time. Because you will have briefed them about the development, yeah? So that when they come next week, they must say, we got the report from the committee, this is our response, this is what we think can be done. And I think that must be the purpose of the meeting. Can we leave it that way? Thank you. At that point, thinking of the board cannot declare the...
Sorry, just one other thing, Chair. Sorry, relating to the Act, minimum sentences. They were... The Act provides for compulsory minimum sentences for children. That was struck out by the Constitutional Court, struck down, non-constitutional. So presumably the Act needs to be amended. When is that, how far is that amendment, if we can just be brief?
Sure, thank you very much. Can you deal with all those issues? Thank you. You've recorded,
Chair, yes, we've taken note of the judgment and we've already suggested amendments to the Act and other legislation as well. It's in our Judicial Matters Amendment Bill, which has been submitted for comments. We should be able to do the amendments or bring it to Parliament within, not until the last month or two months, somewhere around there.
Okay.
Because it's a fairly comprehensive Judicial Matters Amendment. I'll take you on. I've won a few, but I've won a few as well.
I think the key issue is that in the uppermost in our mind is the fact of it, and all the factors that may make it operate towards that. So when we interact with you next week, we deal with those factors. Do they make it impossible the 1st of April? Do they make it possible? If they make it possible, what's going to happen? I think that is exactly what. So, including all the issues of the judicial matters.
Yeah. Obviously, the latter, the judicial matters, will only amend the Act to bring it in line with the judgment of the Constitutional Court. In the meantime, the judgment applies. So, it will not have any effect on the implementation of this Act as such.
Okay. Thank you very much. If there's no substantive matter that qualifies to delay us from going to lines, can I declare, thanking you, having thanked you, that the meeting is closed till further notice? Thank you.
We don't have an idea anymore for politics.